Post-Harlan Monologics, number 00076. Recorded on March 19, 2024. Production location, Post-Harlan, Texas. Vino Vidi Vici Part 1. Chapter 76.
The opinions of Maverick 88 are not necessarily the opinions of Maverick 88. Sensitive content warning. Viewer discretion is advised.
Now, buckle up. You are on the runaway train of thought. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, the one, the only, Maverick 88.
This is Post-Harlan Monologics. I am the living voice of Post-Harlan Monologics. Maverick 88, coming to you from an undisclosed location. Recorded live before no studio audience in the F-150 mobile studio. Yes, we are. On the move. And rolling into Lent. Lent, L-E-N-T, Lent. This is Orthodox Lent. I've spoken about this at some length before. I don't want to do it again right now. But what I do want to say is I have dietary changes as a result of it, right? Our Lent means no meat and no dairy for 40 days, which means, it means a guy like me who eats meat all the time is pretty much screwed, right? It is a challenge. It's been done before. I've done it before. Millions of people have done it. Nobody's going to die over it, right? But we're into it now. As of Sunday night, officially Lent. And since then, I've officially not eaten anything at all. And that's kind of how I do, well, life in general, but even more so at Lent. My tendency is just to not eat as many days as I can possibly do. It's actually easier for me to not eat than it is to eat. So when I get really, really hungry, I will gorge on a couple of the staples that I have. I got to tell you, the staples of my diet during Lent have been burritos, right? Bean burritos, ranch beans burritos with onions and jalapeno. And those are good, you know, for about three or four of them. And then you kind of get tired of it. And then you pay the price the next morning. And then you don't want to eat nothing for a couple of days. So it actually kind of works out well. And the other staple is just what I call bread and grapes. It's literally bread and grapes. I'll get a hunk of bread of some sort and a sack of grapes. I eat them together. And somehow I find it to be a good combination. There's a little inherent difficulty therein, however, in Texas, which apparently is the land of bad bread and bad grapes anymore. It's hard to find good bread and good grapes at the same time. I don't know. I'm just like on this losing streak of sour grapes. I guess. See, you would think, because, you know, produce is a seasonal thing, right? Produce is a seasonal thing, and that you would get grapes as they come from wherever they come from at whatever point you are at in the year, and they're pretty much just going to be the same damn grapes wherever you buy them. But it does not really pan out that way. You know, it seems to depend on the market that you're buying them from, more so than I would ever have thought, and perhaps you also. Here in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex, we have just a particular handful of supermarkets to choose from, and probably there's a few missing from my list. I'm not really out to be as perfectly inclusive as possible. What I know off the top of my head, right? You got these this chain, Tom Thumb and Albertsons, right? They're the same thing with different names that come out of somewhere in California. You obviously have the Walmart, right? Walmart's got their little, well, not so little, but they got their grocery side to it. Then they got these little neighborhood Walmarts, the smaller versions that are specifically groceries. Down in the neighborhoods, off the beaten path, that's from Arkansas. You got Kroger, right? The Kroger supermarkets, they are a Cincinnati-based, Ohio-based organization. Brookshire's is a Texas thing. I've probably spoken about Brookshire's before. Forgive me if I haven't, but they're at Tyler, Texas, and they service the rural community just about exclusively, right? In fact, we had one here in this city where I sit right now a few years ago. And, you know, my wife and I actually prefer Brookshire's. And the next one I'm going to mention, H-E-B, which I spoke at some length about a few episodes back. Both the Texas, you know, the homegrown Texas supermarkets are the ones that we just happen to like. We both like the Brookshire's. We had a Brookshire's right here. And with the urban sprawl that has made its way this far and beyond northeast of Dallas, Brookshire's packed up shop and just left because they don't deal with suburbanites and urbanites. They just don't do it, right? They're a country store, and that's the way they like it. And good for them. And like I said, H-E-B, that's a San Antonio-based supermarket chain. And we got a couple of the quote-unquote foofy ones, you know, the snobbish restaurants. People don't have to go shopping in amongst the riffraff, the Whole Foods, the Central Market. You know, you got that very particular taste, and you're all about spending an extra $5 for something organic. Yeah, those places. The Central Market, of course, is run by H-E-B. I don't know jack shit about Whole Foods. I got a bad taste in my mouth about that kind of place, you know? I don't like foofy. So, kick me in the balls. What do you want me to say? I'm not that kind of guy. And I don't get down with that. But that exists here all the same. And, of course, we got Mexican chains. The biggest, most prominent one around here is, well, we got two of them. They're fairly similarly prominent. I would say there's more stores of El Rancho Supermercado, right? The El Rancho supermarket, which are kind of smaller in size, but more evenly dispersed through the towns. And then the Fiesta Mart, which is a larger supermarket, but there's not as many of them as around, right? And my wife and I, well, we haven't lately, but we used to shop at them all the time. You know, you could tend to get like a larger size jalapenos there, just certain things, and the prices are lower. Things that you don't want to spend a whole lot of money, like cleaning solvents and things like that, you do good at. There's reasons to go in there every once in a while. Of course, half the people in there get freaked out when they see white people, you know. I don't understand that, but that's the culture as it is currently. Anyway, those are the supermarkets around here, just for the sake of posterity. If you transhumanites living in the 22nd century, right? Now, my wife does most of our shopping at the Kroger. It just turns out, like I told you, we like the Texas stores, we like the H-E-B, we like the Brookshire's, but the Kroger's are the best all around pound for pound, supermarket, local to home and to work, right? They're just up and down the tracks of our life. And other stores are too, but this is probably the better one, right? So, and when she goes and gets me things like grapes, for example, they're almost never sour. But when I buy them, they almost always are. But I don't get them at the Kroger usually. I get them at Tom Thumb, right? Tom Thumb. And this is like the recurring nightmare of my life. Right? This is how good my life is, right? That my biggest problem is sour grapes in it, right? I go to this Tom Thumb because it's very convenient to where I work. Very convenient. I do not have to go out of my way. Time matters to me. It's a valuable commodity. And I take my chances, you know. I always take the gamble on the convenience in this case. And I go in there. And this is what happens with Tom Thumb. First of all, their prices on everything tend to be more expensive than anywhere around. And I don't know why. They don't have anything any better or anything different, right? There's nothing special about any of it, but it just costs more, right? So for the convenience to me, I will pay that little bit more. Now, here's the problem, right? Well, especially where grapes are concerned, right? We're talking about cost and grapes. I might go to the Kroger and I might get grapes for like $1.29 a pound. Sometimes less than that. But on the same day or the same week, I'll go into the Tom Thumb and I'll get grapes. They'll be $3.99 a pound. That adds up. Now you get a bag of grapes, 2.5 pounds, which is standard. It's a lot of money for that. And then, this is the kicker. They're almost always sour, and I don't know why. You know, and I guess, like, you could sample a grape. You could just stick your paws in there and grab one and make sure it ain't sour. But a lot of times when I get it, I'm prepping. I'm preparing to break a fast. I'll buy it on my lunch hour at work, but I'm not eating until dinner time. So I won't put one in my mouth. I'll just have to take the chance. I mean, it can't be sour 10 times in a row, can it? Yeah, it can. It can. And this is what I keep on getting. All these Tom Thumb expensive sour grapes. And honestly, the disappointment that comes with it, right? I'll sit down and I'll pull a grape and I'll eat it. And I'm like, oh, not again. I can't believe I did this again. You know, it's almost like a drunkard's tale, right? He finds himself sitting there with a beer in his hand, drinking again after all the problems it's caused him in the past. And he just doesn't understand why. He can't put that shit down and just go a different direction in his life, right? So that's me, the disappointment over these tart, sour, overpriced grapes. That's the living definition of insanity, as they say, right? Doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. Yet here I go. But I tell myself every time, right? I tell myself every time, just don't buy them from there anymore. You don't need them. I'll be walking in a store to get something else. I'll see the grapes over there. They're talking to me, right? And I'm like, nah, I'm not going to get them. They're probably sour anyway, right? And I'm probably right. It's probably true. But they're probably sour anyway. Now, sour grapes, of course, is a common idiom. Idiom. I-D-I-O-M. Idiom. We use that in our lexicon of phraseology, that being sour grapes, to mean, and I quote, a form of denial, of bitterness, that is expressed when one's object of desire is proven beyond reach. Rather than addressing their disappointment, they trivialize the value or importance of the coveted thing, right? And this is, of course, very common amongst people, especially young people, right? The younger we are, the more we have tendencies towards having sour grapes. But adulthood and maturity does not necessarily preclude sour grapes from crossing our paths every once in a while. Right? Like I said, it's a common idiom. It's also a common circumstance. There's an origin to the term, to the idiom, I should say, sour grapes. And it's actually one of those Aesop's fables, right? A-E-S-O-P, Aesop. Aesop's fable. You've heard Aesop's fable. I heard Aesop's fable. That dude over there has heard of Aesop's fables. And look at the girl over there has heard of them also. Everybody's heard of Aesop's fables. Why? Because when you're in elementary school, they're quick to throw Aesop's fable at you. Long before you'll ever get a verse of scripture, you'll have half a dozen or more Aesop's fables thrown at you, right? In fact, I to this day recall a couple of them, just looking down a list, and there's quite an extensive list of these Aesop's fables. And I still remember the boy who cried wolf, right? I still remember the goose that laid the golden eggs. I still remember the town mouse and the country mouse. And there's some that I don't remember that I remember. In other words, what I'm trying to say is there were quite a few more that I was exposed to that I don't recall by the title. But if I was to read through them, I'd be, oh, yeah, yeah, I remember that. Oh, yeah, you're right. Aesop's fables back in the day, and I don't know how it is with kids now, but, you know, the kids in my neighborhood I used to play sports with and run around, hide and go seek, and just make trouble like little kids do, you know, preteen, under 10. And inside the bedroom of, I would say, half the boys, right, there would be the book of Aesop's Fables. That's how common it was. It's like everybody got hit with it in school, and then half of everybody had their own Aesop's Fable book sitting on their shelves. Now, out of the people that had them on their shelves, well, maybe half of them actually read it. I don't know. Or maybe none. Sometimes, you know, your aunt with the mustache and the big wart on her cheek, is she's really good at like giving you gifts that you don't care about when all you want is toys and money and shit, right? Here's a book. Thank you. I don't know. I never had an Aesop's Fable book, so I'm not like a big maven of the Aesop's Fables. I don't even know who Aesop is. Who's Aesop? First of all, let me just, before I get too carried away here, right? The origin of the idiom sour grapes is from an Aesop's fable called The Fox and the Grapes, right? The Fox and the Grapes. And now it's story time with Uncle Maverick. I am going to read to you. It's short. These are all pretty short, right? I'm going to read to you The Fox and the Grapes. A fox one day spied a beautiful bunch of ripe grapes hanging from a vine trained along the branches of a tree. The grapes seemed ready to burst with juice, and the fox's mouth watered as he gazed longingly at them. The bunch hung from a high branch, and the fox had to jump for it. The first time he jumped, he missed it by a long way. So he walked off a short distance and took a running leap at it, only to fall short once more. Again and again he tried, but in vain. Now he sat and looked at the grapes in disgust. "What a fool I am," he said. "Here I am wearing myself out to get a bunch of sour grapes that are not worth gaping for." And he walked off very, very scornfully. So, that's it. Now, this is an Aesop fable, and with these Aesop's fables, you always get a quote-unquote moral to the story, right? That's part of what a fable is. I will define a fable for you. A fable is a usually short narrative making an edifying or cautionary point and often employing as characters animals that speak and act like humans, right? And then the use of the word fable and subsequent definitions have morphed over time to where a fable becomes a falsehood and a lie, right? That's a stretch, but that's evolution for you, right? We don't mean fable in that regard, we mean fable as a type of, well, like a usually short narrative, right? It's perhaps a little outlandish in the use of animals behaving as human beings behave, but it's not a lie. It's a story, and the story has a point to it, a moral. There's an objective lesson in it, and the moral of the story of the fox and the grapes, of the fable of the fox and the grapes, as they have it described here, I would probably do personally a better job of describing here. It is easy to despise what you cannot get, right? Easy to despise what you cannot get. And I think of it as more of, as I defined the idiom before, right? And it was actually a definition that I pulled down off of some vague and unnoted reference from the internet. A form of denial, right? Let's start with that idea. We're denying, right? Here you had these grapes that were coveted. The fox really wanted them. They looked ready to go. He's hungry. It's the right thing at the right time. But he can't get them, right? He can't reach them, quote unquote, reach them. And therefore, he turns to despise them. And the idea was that these grapes were probably sour anyway. I can't get them, and they're probably no good, no how. You know? They suck. And that's what you're doing, is really passing blame onto something else to hide from your own damn self your inability, your insufficiency, right? To hide from yourself and then try to hide perhaps from others your weakness, your failing, your literal, as the fable goes, shortcoming, right? He fell short of the reach of the grapes and he turned to despise that which he coveted. And there's a big deal in there. It's that lying to ourselves and denying ourselves as a result of it. Passing the blame onto something that doesn't warrant blame and carrying around bitterness over it. How might a person react in this situation? Rather than with bitterness and walking away and giving up, a person might better just simply admit that I don't have the wheels to propel me that high up into the air to get the dang grapes. But it ain't the grapes' fault that I can't do it. It's just the way things are. I need help, right? And here's the problem. Well, here's one of the problems. We have a hard time, often, just asking for help. Our pride, our ego, our vanity gets in the way. Sometimes we tell ourselves we just don't want to be a bother to anybody, but the truth of the matter is we are hiding our insufficiency. We are hiding our inability. We are hiding our inadequacy. And if we go to ask for help, all these things that we're hiding even from ourselves stands to be and likely will be revealed. Our vanity cannot handle the truth of ourselves because we, in our self-centeredness, are so prone to spending so much of our time in our brains propping up the false image of who we are. And every time we encounter some kind of failing in ourselves, it chops that imagery, that false imagery, out by the knees. And we cannot have it. It takes too much work to build up the illusion of self to allow the reality to knock it back down. And we don't want to get real. We want to live in our imaginations. This is what vanity is all about. You know, this is what vanity is all about. So there's a real lot of depth to a very simple fable, an Aesop's fable. Now, who the hell was Aesop? That's a good question. Nobody really knows, right? The general story goes like this, but it's got a lot of holes in it. That he's from like 600 years before Christ, that perhaps he was some kind of slave or an indentured servant that came out of slavery. And there's some mention about him doing some diplomatic missions that he moved from town to town like a slave wouldn't do. And he wrote these fables, and that's kind of it. That's the basic story. But like I said, even the basic story's got a lot of holes in it. There's no actuality to it. And there is perhaps an argument to be had that a lot of these quote-unquote Aesop's fables weren't written by anybody named Aesop at all. They are just some kind of word-of-mouth thing used to teach kids. This comes out of ancient Greece, by the way. I should have mentioned that. The idea is that Aesop came out of somewhere in Greece. But again, legend has other potential areas around the Eastern Mediterranean, right? Where he may have come from and where he may have lived, where he may have been enslaved, where he may have done his writings. But these end up being word-of-mouth teachings in that region of the world over centuries that are just compiled and taught generation to generation. And of course, if you start out with 10 of them, somebody's going to add another one here and somebody's going to add another one there. So there may not really be an Aesop, or Aesop may have only did like one or two of them and got the ball rolling, right? We don't know. We don't know. So much of the things in this life, we don't really know. So who the hell is Aesop? That's about as good as an answer I could give you right now, right? I told you what a fable is. I told you the fables that I recall learning as a child. And I read to you The Fox and the Grapes, which is the origin of the idiom sour grapes. So speaking of grapes, because apparently that's what we're doing here, right? Speaking of grapes. Over the weekend, my wife and I watched the old 1940 Hollywood production called The Grapes of Wrath, right? The Grapes of Wrath movie. Starring Henry Fonda for one person, and of course this is the story that is based on the John Steinbeck book of the same name, The Grapes of Wrath, right? Very, very famous, very well-known, what, a Nobel Prize for Literature winning, you know, that sort of American classic literature from the early half of the 1900s, right, the 20th century, John Steinbeck. And here's the thing. I went through a phase with John Steinbeck as an author. I read a bunch of his books in sequence. 1 year of my life, I don't know, late 20s, early 30s. And just about all these books were something that we were assigned to read in high school, right? These were books that we were supposed to read and report on collectively as a class, right? And I would say most high schools across the country had this stuff shoved in their face the course of their education. But I didn't read them in high school. I didn't do shit in high school. I smoked pot and chased girls is what I did, you know, and maybe got in a couple of fights and things like that. But I didn't read John Steinbeck. I didn't care to. It meant nothing to me. I didn't take part in my education almost at all, right? But later on in life, it would come to me. What sprung me into this, I don't know. I was probably reading something else and reading something else that referred to it, and it piqued my interest momentarily. I looked at something, and it turned out to be quite good, right? The writing style is good. It's easygoing, and a lot of these stories, they have you traveling, you know, especially east of Eden. I read these. I read these books, and I read The Grapes of Wrath, and I've seen the movie Grapes of Wrath a few times. I read Of Mice and Men, Winter of My Discontent, East of Eden, like I mentioned. There's probably other stuff, too. I kind of vaguely recall having my hands on a short story book that I don't remember what it was called or what any of the short stories were. And I don't know what else. But I went through this phase for a couple of months of my life, right? And I went into all this stuff. And the reason we watched The Grapes of Wrath is because we were watching another movie, right? We were watching another movie from the early 70s. And this was one weeknight last week. I'd come home from work and we're just sitting there. Just had a little time to kill. And I was looking for a movie for my wife and I to watch. And I found this movie, just stumbled on it. One of those YouTube things, you know, called I Walk the Line, which is a Johnny Cash song, a very famous Johnny Cash song. And we like country music and country movies and cowboy movies. And neither of us had ever heard of this. It's like, well, what the hell is this? Is this some kind of like Johnny Cash story or something like that? Well, Johnny Cash had nothing to do with it except for the title of the movie and the music in the movie. Yeah. But he didn't act in it or anything like that. It was not a story about him, thankfully. What it was a tale of small hillbilly town in north of Tennessee, north central Tennessee. A family of moonshiners moved in from somewhere across the county into this other village, or somewhere on the outskirts of some other village. And, their fortune had it where their young, beautiful teenage daughter had an encounter with the sheriff, the county sheriff in the town there, and they took advantage. It was apparent that this sheriff, who was a married man, who was significantly older, he had salt and pepper hair, he had to be pushing 50 or more, had a real fondness for this teenage girl. That was evident to the family, and the father thought, hey, we get this sheriff in our back pocket by basically pulling an Epstein on him, right? It was kind of a blackmail situation. He got the guy to be involved with his own daughter in exchange for leniency about his moonshining business. You follow the gist of the story here. And so the girl set out and lured the sheriff in, and he took the bait, hook, line, and sinker. And that's the basic premise of the story. It didn't really end good. Why would it? And between my wife and I, we were never able to figure out how I Walked the Line fits as a title for that, because it's exactly what the guy didn't do. Walking the line is another idiom, right? It's an idiom for being faithful in your marriage, being faithful in your relationships. You walk the line, you just stay steady. You don't stagger, you don't cheat, you don't commit adultery, right? And you know, Johnny Cash sung that song at a time when he, in his first marriage, about his life on the road, but staying committed to the marriage and not cheating on his wife. And then what happened? Well, he cheated on her anyway later on, right? And then he ended up in a second marriage, which is a nationally famous marriage with June Carter, right? June Carter, the Carter family, which brings you back to the very inception of country music in the far, far western reaches of Virginia, right? Almost into Tennessee out there. Excellent story, excellent place. You're talking Blue Ridge Mountains and all that, but Johnny, the idea of walking the line had nothing to do with this movie. It was just weird. But I bring all that up just to say the actor was a guy, very famous. I've heard the name before, but I just don't know his movies. A guy called Gregory Peck, right? Gregory Peck. And his appearance, right, looked so familiar to me. And I couldn't put my finger on it for a moment, and then I did. And when I did, what it was he resembled the guy on a book cover of a John Steinbeck book, right? I can't say John Steinbeck without saying Jine. I'm like putting them all together. It's like vagina, right? John Steinbeck. He wrote the book. It was called The Winter of My Discontent. There was an old soft cover version of it that had a picture of a guy. I think he was standing there like over a broom with the handle towards his chin or something like that. But the way I remember the image looked exactly like this Gregory Peck dude who played the sheriff in I Walk the Line, right? So I was thinking, you know, I don't even remember what the hell that story was about. I read it, and it's been a long time, what, 25 years maybe more than that. Somewhere like 25, 30 years ago, I read the book, but I do not remember the story. And I was just wondering, you know, it seems like there's a movie about every book that you ever thought of reading. So maybe somebody made like a little movie or a miniseries or a TV show, you know, TV movie, made for TV movie about the Winter of My Discontent, and we'll just go through that story again. I'm always looking for something to do, like to introduce my wife to. Always trying to find something entertaining for her. It's part of the mechanism of our being, right? So I go searching for the Winter of My Discontent, and lo and behold, I found there was a made-for-TV version of the story from somewhere, obviously, in the early 80s. It was a digital version of a video cassette recording of the TV show, and the quality was so horrible you couldn't watch it. And to make matters double worse, Donald Sutherland played the main character, and I said, I just never really got along. I don't know the guy personally. It's just his way, his inflection, his mannerisms, his demeanor, I never really liked, you know, with full apologies to a man I don't know. I don't mean to bag him. It's a taste thing, you know, like I don't like broccoli. I can't help that. I'm not queer. I can't help that. It just is what it is. So there's two reasons I really couldn't watch it. And the third one was this actor was portraying the role of some guy who's just like very happy and very positive, right? But did it like over the top. So I'm starting to think, all right, the story, The Winter of My Discontent, here's a guy somewhere, there's discontentedness taking his life over. So you have to express the amount of discontent by first expressing this over-the-top amount of positivity. What do I mean by that? This guy's walking through his village, and he's like saying hello to the flowers, and hello, Mr. Fire Hydrant. It was over-the-top. It was just, forget this. I'm almost certain that John Steinbeck didn't write it that way. I could be wrong. I've been wrong before. It happens every once in a while. But I couldn't watch it. It was just not watchable. But I had it in my head. It's like, well, how about East of Eden? I knew there was a miniseries and a movie for that, right? Neither of them really reflected the book well. It was a big, fat book. The movie was just, there was not enough time in a Hollywood movie production to really tell that story. That was James Dean. It was a James Dean movie, right? The miniseries was done in the late 70s. It was good, and there was more time to tell the story. I don't recall feeling that it really did the story justice. I would have watched that over again, but I couldn't find that looking it up, right? Of Mice and Men, we actually watched, I think last summer, we found some version of it, which was good. It was actually done very well. Of course, that's a much shorter story, and I think it was actually written as a, with the intention of being some kind of like a screenplay or a theatrical performance. And it translated very well to film. But then there's left like The Grapes of Wrath, and that's the classic. And I was like, all right, it's been a long time. I mean, I remember the story, but let's just watch that. I like Dust Bowl history, and that's what this is. It's the Okies being run out by the Dust Bowl and run off their land by the banks that had no forgiveness, no leniency, and they end up traveling down Route 66 on the way to California, where they heard that there's all kinds of farm work to be done. And you should know the story by now. I don't want to get into the whole story of it at this moment in time, but so we watched that this weekend. We watched Grapes of Wrath, and then it started to trigger in my mind, you know, just some of, really a lot of stuff. It's really a powerful, powerful story. The difficulty in going through the story is you're watching Americana happen in front of you, but you're seeing the dirty pool that's involved with it, right? It starts with the banks and no leniency. You have this very rare phenomenon, this Dust Bowl thing that happened in that part of the country, kind of around the Oklahoma Panhandle, up into Colorado, down into Texas, where these dust storms were welling up as a result of poor farming practices on the Western Plains over there, in a sequence of dry years, of drought years. All of a sudden, all that pasture land that had always held the dirt down dried up and blew away, and then the dust came after it, and everything was just, everything in its wake was just buried and killed. There was no rain for growing. It was just a mess. So it's just a rare circumstance that happened in the history of our country. And the banks who had mortgages on the land of all these farmers who were affected by this, they just swooped in like vultures. You don't pay, you can get the hell out. Now the land is ours. So they get the land for dirt cheap, and then they'll turn around and sell it off to some corporate conglomerate in time. And the people are just out, right? So there's no care. It's all business, and it's always all business. And that's a problem, not only in this world in general, but especially in our nation, right? It starts to show, it starts to expose the problem. So now here in, you know, on the eastern side of the Rocky Mountains, you've got this problem with the agriculture going on, the Dust Bowl. You go on the other side of the Rockies and cross the desert in the Great Basin, you end up in California, where everything is lush and green. It's a complete flip side, right? But you still have the same problems over there. The people who own the land, right? They are hiring migrant workers at prices that don't even pay for them to feed themselves, because there's so many of them come over. Right? So it becomes just a matter of abuse. You get this work from you get these guys to work for next to nothing, and you profit on your peaches and your avocados and whatever very handsomely. All the wealth comes back to you, and it's part of a whole system, a good old boys network, you know, where you get the county sheriff involved, the deputies. They're battling for you because you got all the money and you pay all their way, right? And all these people are taking abuse. Now, with the John Steinbeck books, it has this tendency, at least this story, especially this story, has this tendency to have, you know, a socialist type of government structure come in, as it was in the 30s when the book was written. The New Deal of FDR, right? Franklin Delano Roosevelt and his New Deal practice. You bring in this socialism to kind of be the government coming in, and that's like the beginning of the mother's tit, the government's mama tit that this country is now so dependent upon, right? That was the inception of it right there. The need for a union existed because of the monopolistic attitude of those who had any kind of wealth and the power that comes with wealth, right? It starts to make a suggestion that the problem is the economic system of what we call quote-unquote capitalism, and then the solution, especially the way it was portrayed in the movie, was your socialist slash communist government entity coming in and really being kind to the migrant workers and setting them up with a nice life. That even was a little bit over the top, right? I'm sure the situation wasn't exactly that way. But this is how socialism and communism works into a society. It comes through the government. It shows a first nice face, but the backside of it is, hey, meet the new boss, same as the old boss, right? These corrupt, monopolistic oligarch people, the landowners who lord it over the migrant workers, they're one version of scumbaggery that demands a solution, and then the government solution is what? To come in and just replace the old boss with the new boss, to become the new boss, to be the scumbags. Communism always ends up being, what, a two-tier system. The haves and the have-nots. There's no middle class. They get obliterated. Everybody becomes a slave, right? But it has to start somewhere and then spreads like a cancer, right? These stories, the reality of these stories is not about capitalism versus communism. It's about the fact that we do not have an economic system that eliminates the corruption of men's souls. The corruption is the problem. Nearly any economic system that we have imagined, right? I remember having a course in high school. I took it twice because A, I liked it, and B, I just didn't do the homework because that's how I am, right? It was called A Challenge of Ideas, and it was about fascism, socialism, communism, capitalism. It was a challenge of these four basic ideas of economics through governance. But the reality of the situation is, like, even in what we call our capitalistic system here, we have elements of all the rest incorporated into it. Because all these things come naturally to the human experience. The fascism comes naturally. The socialism, the communism, the capitalism, all these ideas are inherent, and certain situations require certain answers from certain different poles, from certain different directions. The problem with every single one of them is the corruption of men. That's the problem, and none of them address that problem, right? That's what I'm hung up now on with my thoughts now. It's like, well, all right, how do we make an economic system that drives the evil out of it? There's a real challenge for some brilliant minds. Now, John Steinbeck got a lot of flack as a result of the angle he took with regards to vilifying these landlords, these bosses, right? These massive major rancher farmers in California and all their cohorts, right? John Steinbeck was pegged as a communist. Books were banned. You know, that's the irony. The books were banned early on. But then they were actually shoved in our face later on, all over the fact of communism, right? Their communist ideas and everything like that. I don't know that John Steinbeck goes down into the grave as a communist. I've read about his faith. He was raised as some kind of Protestant, Episcopalian, I think. I think that's as relative to his life as Roman Catholicism was to mine. It was something I inherited through the family. I didn't give a shit about, and I turned my back on it just about as soon as I could. John Steinbeck is listed as an agnostic, right? Which is pretty much what I became for most of my adult life. Or, I don't know, became, I probably was always that, to some degree. That's his faith. As far as his politics are concerned, I never really saw clear. I have the impression that the guy evolved through his life from more liberal in the youth to more conservative in an older age, but never really had any kind of idea that communism was the answer. And I could be wrong about this. It may be that he went through a phase where he was kind of communistic in his ideology. And perhaps the people who were bagging him so much did it rightfully so. But you know they did what they did out of personal spite and vengeance for being vilified the way they were, right? These massive California ranches who were absolutely abusing the Okies. And that's a historical fact. A very sad historical fact. I look at that situation. It's like, all right, let's do break-even business. Let's make sure that these people survive this mess somehow. what's a couple of years, right? It's not like the ranch is going to go down in flames or anything like that. No, the matter is that we're not going to, I'm not going to have gazillions and gazillions, you know. My monopoly is at risk, and my competitors stand to gain. We suck. Humanity sucks. Human beings suck. And it makes reaching your hand out to help so difficult. It really does. I can almost understand somebody being that selfish. I can imagine them have gone through their lives and being slapped around, disrespected, pissed on the way that people have the tendency to do, right? And then finally coming to some kind of wealth and some kind of power and just giving the old Jersey bird to the whole world. And when something horrible befalls these people, to hell with them all. Good for you. You deserve it, right? I can understand where an attitude like this might, how that might evolve and develop in a person. I carry so much negativity about humanity. My job, you know, I just see all this crap all the time. I see how people are. I see how people can be. But there's a breaking point with me, you know? And that is, if I see somebody who is tormented, who is troubled, I forget all that. I do. The compassion exists inside of me that counters all of this negativity. How we fail as a collective in these harrowing times, like the Dust Bowl, right? And the migration that happened as a result of it. How nobody seemed to really give a shit about the people. It perplexes me. The thing about John Steinbeck's stories is they will make you think. And that's always worth it, right? It's always worth it. Whoever he was, whatever he was about, it'll make you think. It's a story worth looking at. All 4 of these stories are worth looking at. In the Grapes of Wrath, in a way, seem to target the tyranny of local landowners, ranchers, farmers, agricultural magnates in California who mistreated, to say the least, the migrant workers that fled Oklahoma in desperation as a result of that horrible Dust Bowl that happened there during the Great Depression, right? You had Dust Bowl on top of Depression. Things sucked. And these people in desperation went out to really do the lowest of common labor work for the least of standards of life. And on top of that, got kicked in the dick. You know, it's just, it's a horrible thing, right? So Steinbeck wrote about that particular brand of American tyranny that was occurring in those years. And those same tyrants turned from the migrant worker against the writer, John Steinbeck. They beleaguered this guy. They went after him in every which way. They were banning books in counties and states because they were linking him with communism, right? And that's kind of where I left off. And I had stated that in my recollection, at the best of my memory, I understood that Steinbeck wrote these things, but was not necessarily a socialist or communist because he was in the literary clique of the era. He was probably rubbing elbows with a lot of leftists, but my understanding was in his old age, in his maturity, he was starting to kind of drift a little bit towards the right, right? And so I looked just to verify that. You know, I took a moment, went back and looked, and oh, indeed, he did rub elbows with leftists for most of his life. And there was good reason to suspect him of socialism and communism, suspect him of being a mouthpiece of those particular economic systems, right? having some kind of ties and relationship, perhaps, to even to the Soviet Union. Why? Because he actually went on a trip there with a bunch of other lefties, right? In the heat of the Cold War, there he is touring Russia, Moscow, St. Petersburg, Leningrad, whatever the hell, Stalingrad, wherever he went, all these different Russia cities for this like whirlwind tour. That kind of raised the eyebrows of a couple of federal bureaus, but yes, indeed, in the end, he did fall to becoming at odds with the same leftists that championed his works through his life, right? In fact, when I say that, right, I talk about a period of time, post-war United States, when the Grapes of Wrath was banned, right? It was a banned book in parts of the country. But by the time I was going to school, which was less than 30 years later, 25 years later, we were having John Steinbeck literature forced down our gullet, because the communism was already starting to infiltrate the educational systems, through the federal government level and all the monies that they would rain down upon the school districts and shit like that. That's how it's done. And they get something for their money, right? And what they get for their money is a leftist ideology. So, boom, you take this Steinbeck that if it wasn't out and out socialism / communism, it was at least leaning in that way. And you can get a kid at an age of intrigue and wondering to start contemplating the type of problems that would start to lead people to really consider communism as a solution, right? And of course, the problem really in this situation is not the method of economics, not the system that's being applied. Again, any system of economics would probably work if everybody stuck to the rules. Everybody had an understanding. Everybody played their part. Problem is, no matter what system you apply, whatever system you apply, none of them factor in the human capacity for corruption. Corruption eats away and destroys every single economic ideology out there. So that doesn't really matter. You could waste years of your life comparing the merits of capitalism versus communism, socialism and fascism. You can do this and you can do this and you can do this. But the bottom line is, as soon as corruption enters the picture of any of these ideas, any of these theories, any of these methods, then it's screwed. And none of them actually factor in man's propensity towards corruption. That's how I view the situation. And this is not to take away from the horror that monopolistic-minded scumbags bring to the picture, okay? That is an ugly chapter in the history of the United States. And honestly, it never really stopped. The rich will be rich. The rich will do rich things. The rich will try to wipe out competition. They will always seek a monopoly. They always want the big, easy money. And they always want to put people under their thumb, right? But going back to John Steinbeck, like I said, in the end, he became at odds with his leftist cohorts over his stance regarding the war in Vietnam. And I think he took a particular interest in the hardships of actual American soldiers, right? Which, why wouldn't you? They're just soldiers. They're 17, 18-year-old kids out there, fighting a war they don't understand jack shit about, right? Against all odds, because they're not supposed to win. They're just supposed to be out there at war. There was no real goal in it except to create wartime profits for these scumbag monopolist oligarch douchebags, right? My father was teaching me this when I was a little kid. I already had these ideas in my head about Vietnam. His take was, it was all about the Huey helicopter, right? Howard Hughes. Why my father went off on that angle, I don't know. It was much bigger than that. If that was even a part of it at all, it was a small part. But his example to me would be like, he had this gazillionaire Howard Hughes who had made all these helicopters, these little choppers, and they fought the war in Vietnam, so a guy like him could just unload all these helicopters and make more and unload more, right? Use them all up, get them blown up, have people die, but all the money come back, you know? It's the example, the truth of it all. You know, I think my father meant well in trying to convey what he understood about the way this world works, or technically actually fails to work, right? That's what I'm talking about here, that corrupt element in it all. But anyway, John Steinbeck had a heart for the American soldier, and that kind of crossed all the leftists back here in the States. Funny. They hated the soldiers. They hated everything. They hated what they called the establishment. Anything that wasn't really communist, because that's what these leftists ultimately are. You know, when you pair it all back, what they want to do is replace the existing power, whatever that may be, with their idea what power ought to be, right? Now you got a situation where the communists basically have the power and they don't seem to know what to do with it, right? It's not to say that we're in a communist society, but they've got their fingers in every pie. They literally have become the establishment, but they just can't. I don't want to get into that. This is not the point of what I'm saying here. The point of what I'm trying to say is that in the end, Steinbeck, something triggered in him that got him, at least in the process of separating, like a wedge was driven between him and the leftist cohorts of his. And he may not actually have been communist after all. And it may have been, you know, in my way of thinking, having had read his books and just kind of putting all the chronology of everything together, it may really have been the seeds of faith that he was raised in, whatever the Episcopal, you know, I haven't heard anything good about Episcopal church and what their beliefs are or anything like that. I don't really understand it. I don't really care. I don't really care at this point in my life. You know, it's another Protestant, and it's going to be kind of off the mark as a result. You know, that's simple. So whatever the peculiarities are that separate Episcopals from other Protestants, I don't know. I don't really care. But somewhere in this is always going to be the matter of Jesus Christ. And with the matter of Jesus Christ, you're always going to be involved with the principles, the morals of being in accordance with Jesus Christ, right? So you'll at least have that morality, which you can sum up with the Ten Commandments. And it seems to me that in Steinbeck's writing, there was often this little tinge of faith. Sometimes outright expressions. He involved, he incorporated, for example, Holy Scripture in the East of Eden. Just look at the title, right? East of Eden, that's a reference to what? Cain and Abel, you know, Adam and Eve being sent off to the East of Eden, and Cain being sent off to the land of Nod from there, right? So you're going right back to the beginning of Genesis, the beginning of humanity, with the reference in the title there. And I got to tell you, Grapes of Wrath, I'm going to get to this. I'm going to save this one for later, right? Grapes of Wrath also becomes biblical. So why all this Bible reference and all these supposed quote-unquote communist literary works by John Steinbeck, right? In East of Eden specifically, and I read this and I saw the movie and I saw the miniseries, and I think I might have even read it a second time. I really did like that story. It would be interesting for me to look at again. I don't read stories anymore, so I won't do it. But it would be interesting for me to look at again with the perspective I've gained. First, converting willfully, you know, on my own volition to Christianity, and then eventually making the conversion into Orthodox Christianity. What I would see in what Steinbeck is writing, you know, I think his Christianity exists, but it would be thin, an upbringing that he didn't follow through on. This is my guess. You know, it's hard to toy around with where a man is with his faith at any given time. So I don't really mean to do that. I'm just kind of going with what I got here. And I think faith may have played a part in this guy's life as he aged. Just those seeds of what he had as a Protestant growing up that he turned away from and regarded himself publicly as an agnostic. But why wouldn't you when you're hanging out with a bunch of leftists? Maybe on down the way in his life, why he's writing these things. It's very hard to write about Christian moral concepts in any kind of book, because you really got to be careful to get it right for every reason in the world, which means you have to look at it and look again and look again. Believe me, I'm writing a theological book right now. There is not one sentence that I put in there that doesn't go through all kinds of scrutiny, right? Very difficult to put something down and move on from it. And I'm sure in this guy's process of writing, he had a little bit of that difficulty too. I remember particularly, in East of Eden, he had one of the main characters had some kind of Chinaman servant. I can't remember the guy's name, unfortunately. He ended up being an important character in the story, more towards the end of it. But he was very interested in Holy Scripture, in the Bible. And he would go through and parse the text. And he got hung up on this one phrase, right? I think it was, "Thou mayest," right? "Thou mayest." And he didn't understand what that was. And he kept on looking at it and trying to understand it. And I remember that for some reason, right? I read this before I was a Christian. I was still an Antichrist when I read all these Steinbeck books. But for some reason, that stuck with me. And I don't even know what the verse is for all the Bible I've read and taught and everything, right? Preached on. "Thou mayest." Where the hell does that even happen? And I should have looked that up. I should have looked it up before I got into this here. But he had a problem with that phrasing. You know, that's the an old English style. And I think the way it played out was finally he had an aha moment where it all came together and it made sense for him what the meaning was and how it fit in with the context of everything else involved in those verses. And, you know, it's kind of a big deal. The guy's struggling to understand Scripture, right? And the fact that John Steinbeck made that a significant enough part of the story that I would remember it above all else, right? Above all else that happened in that very large book, very long story, is kind of incredible. And I don't think it can be overlooked. I really think that that guy had to put a lot of focus into at least certain elements of Christianity, right? He may have been, like authors tend to do, expressing his own difficulty understanding faith. You know, it's weird. We can believe without understanding. In fact, it's pretty much the way it goes. We believe at heart because God lives in our heart. Even if you're an Antichrist son of a bitch, you have the breath of life in you, and believe it or not, that's God. Whether you like it or not, whether you like the Creator or not, that's God in you. And you know it at some level. You have this inherent knowledge of God with you. And, you know, many of us spend time denying it, and many of us spend time just confused about it. And then eventually some of us actually get with it and really start moving forward, you know, like the wind in the sail sort of thing. And someday, someday in the afterlife, I may come to know this, and I may come to find out, where was John Steinbeck in the end? What was causing that wedge, really, really, that wedge that was occurring between him and the leftists? Or was it these questions of faith? Now, this book, East of Eden, he wrote, or at least it was published in 1952, which is a solid 30 years after Grapes of Wrath was written, right? So he was much older. He was much older at that point in his life, and he was contemplating. Obviously, he was contemplating things about the faith of his upbringing, Christianity, in a general sense. And then, you know, another 10, 15 years down the road, how much further did this guy actually get answering the questions of his faith and taking the faith to heart? And how much of that acceptance of his own faith start to change the way he viewed things, change his beliefs, and start to separate him from the commie leftists that he hung around with? See what I'm saying? Christianity will have that kind of impact on a person, right? I've seen it 100 times. It's very funny. You know, I may have brought it up before. I have social media, right? On one of my social media accounts, I have it kind of set aside specifically for friends and family, people who I actually know, right? I get friend requests from people who are like friends of friends who I don't know. I either don't accept it or I do accept it until I find out who it is. And when I find out it's somebody I don't know, I give it a little bit of time to try to find to get to know them, and when that doesn't happen, I go through a period where I quote unquote chop heads. I just get, because I want it to be people I know. I want it to be people who are important to me or have been important to me in my life, and I just want to follow along what's going on, right? So I have this social media, and I have all these friends, and so many of them are my burnout friends from high school, right? So many of them burnout friends from high school. And what I've noticed with these people is they are surprisingly very much like me. We were leftist in orientation while we were smoking pot and snorting coke and dropping acid and drinking whiskey. I quit all that stuff, and that began my transition into a more of a quote-unquote conservative perspective on existence, right? But these people, whether they quit or not, they all seem to grow up to be conservative. It's really remarkable, right? Maturity somehow set in. And when it does, people come out conservative. Go figure, right? So perhaps as John Steinbeck matured, the seeds of the faith in him began to open his eyes up some. Perhaps. Nonetheless, corruption is the actual matter at hand where the story of the Grapes of Wrath is concerned.
This monologue is continued in the next episode, Chapter 00077, Vino Vidi Vici Part 2.
Thank you for tuning into Post-Stalin Monologics. Further information involving this project and archived releases of Post-Stalin Monologics can be accessed over the World Wide Web at poststalin.com. Comments, critiques, and inquiries may be submitted to Maverick through email at maverick88@poststalin.com.